Hello, this is Barbara Peters. I'm sitting here with an author that I have had the pleasure and privilege of publishing, Annie Hogsett, who writes a series for Poison Pen Press, and set in Cleveland, which I think is so much fun. Annie, are you from Cleveland?
I am not from Cleveland. I am from West Virginia, from a very small town. I am like Allie Harper, my protagonist, in that I'm from a very small town in West Virginia, and I... my husband got a job in a law firm in Cleveland, and we moved to Cleveland in 72. So, you know, we're Clevelanders now. We're all Clevelanders now. But I have that West Virginia perspective. I'm a small town girl in a big city, and I see it through those eyes sometimes.
Do you know, I think oftentimes people who are outsiders write the best about places. You don't assume, you know, things because they aren't where you grew up. And I really have always thought that outsiders had a narrative advantage.
And I think, you know, being an outsider in Cleveland is such a quirky town. And I think as somebody who's not from Cleveland, sees Cleveland the way it's always been, I'm delighted and surprised by things that other people might be appalled by. There is a storefront that I pass by occasionally where they sell... it is an exterminator and a choir robe and Bible store under one roof. And that just cracks me up every time. It's just, that's so Cleveland. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that and kind of fun.
That's hilarious. Well, I'm from Chicago, which when I was growing up in the 40s and 50s was very much an ethnic town. You know, it had definite groups of I think at one point Chicago might have had a larger Polish population than Warsaw after the war, because Warsaw had been so decimated, as you know. And I've always thought of Cleveland as having at least two, because there was a wonderful mystery writer called Les Roberts.
I know Les, yes.
Okay, and remember he had two distinct ethnic groups in Cleveland,
yes.
And he named his character Milo Yakovic.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Out of them.
Yes.
And so to me, Cleveland has always been a bit like Chicago in my mind, but I'm now half a century out of date.
No, not really, because in my neighborhood, where I live, there's still a strong Slovenian population.
It's interesting how different Europeans went to different, you know, West Virginia tended to attract the Welsh because of the mining.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the Finns went to Minnesota and, you know, people from Germany and all went to Wisconsin because the landscaping was familiar. The Scots went to the Carolinas because it was like the Highlands.
Yeah.
So I can't, why would Slovenians like Cleveland?
I don't know, but there was a tremendous population. I live in Collingwood, and Collingwood was a Slovenian community forever. And there was some flight out of the city as it changed. But they were attracted perhaps to the railroad yards. The Collingwood Yards was a major train yard. And it was a strong industrial thing for Collingwood. And there was a lot of manufacturing, not so much anymore. So it's not that, but the Slovenian culture is still there. And one of my characters, Lisa Cole, who is Allie's sort of friend, nemesis from time to time, is Slovenian, and she's from the neighborhood, and she's changed her name from Tibolch to Cole. So
makes good sense. Yeah, it might be a simple answer. It might just be that a number of Slovenians got there and then started sending for their friends and relatives.
I don't know, but clearly that's
sure. But I mean, it just could have been a nucleus of settlers who then attracted people from
brought their
home.
People in and
yep. So maybe I'm looking too hard for other reasons.
No,
how funny. So tell me a little bit about Allie and Tom, because you have two protagonists, although Allie is the lead protagonist. Where did this whole idea come from of having blind Tom and what do we call Allie? What would you call her? Energetic? She's
energetic. She's sassy. She's spunky. She has a tremendously warm heart. She's extemporaneous. She's somebody who grew up in West Virginia and moved to Cleveland and was in a very unfortunate, very short, fortunately short marriage. And she's in a place in her life where she's, you know, sort of in between. And she finds Tom. And it began because I was coming out of the McDonald's across from my grocery store, and somebody honked at a blind man in the crosswalk.
Oh, that actually happened.
It happened right in front of my face. And I said, I don't think I said it out loud, although I do talk to myself out loud in the car sometimes. Wow, you know you live in a rough neighborhood when somebody honks at a blind man in the crosswalk. And that's the first line of the book.
Very true.
And
so
I didn't know anything right then except that my second thought is, because I'm a writer, whoa, that's a really good line. You know, I could use that line. Who is that? Who said that? And I went home and sat down, and by the end of the day, I had the first chapter, and I knew that Allie Harper was who I've described, and that Tom was, you know, he was the smart, hot, great guy that she'd been looking for, and he was also blind, and that in his grocery bag was the lottery ticket he'd bought to prove to a kid that gambling doesn't pay.
Yes, I've always liked the irony of that he bought the ticket as an exemplar for this kid, and he said he won the lottery with
it. And the thing about the Tom, the thing that made it interesting to me, I thought, well, okay, this is a story that I've heard before. Somebody's got a lottery ticket and they're in trouble. But usually it's somebody who's played the lottery to win, thinking it's going to be a great thing, and it turns out to be a bad thing. Well, for Tom, he played the lottery not to win. So it's the irony that he's totally satisfied with his life. I mean, he's ready for a romance, obviously, because he and Allie fall in love almost immediately. But, you know, he wasn't looking to make money. He was looking to show the kid that they weren't even going to get one number right.
In point of fact, and this has been borne out by so many instances, and in fact, there's a really good older English mystery to this effect, that winning that kind of money is a real burden.
Oh,
instead
curse.
Of it can be a curse. It can warp your life. It attracts unwelcome attention, which is certainly a factor in your books.
It
you
is.
Know, people who are trying to like get a piece of the money or take it all away from you, or at least some of it away from you. I'm trying to remember the name. It's a really interesting British detective story. Basically, the police arrive at a house after they're called, and breakfast is on the table, and the tea is still in the pot, and everyone's gone.
Yeah.
And there's absolutely no indication of foul play, but the entire family is missing. And eventually they figure out it's because the Morning Post comes so early in Britain that the Post had come in, and they had seen it, and immediately
left town.
Exactly, immediately rebooted, grabbed everything and rebooted their lives, because mm-hmm. they knew that having won this, whatever it was, lottery, that they would then be at the mercy of family and neighbors and con men and, you know, shady business
right.
associates, even legitimate
right.
and charities.
Yeah.
You know, all of
oh,
whom.
Yeah. It's just trouble on the road.
Right.
Coming right at them.
So Allie and Tom, what did they decide to do with this windfall? Because I like the fact that they do something good with it.
Well, they do. Their desire is to make it worth something. They, you know, to have it to be charitable. And I think their plan is to give it to something in Cleveland. Allie wants to see their name on it on a hospital. You know, and she says then we'd be married for sure then, because they still aren't married and that hasn't happened yet. But they want to, you know, they obviously want to do something charitable with it. But they've had trouble because they've been so occupied with trying not to get, you know, kidnapped or killed or whatever through this series. They're just at a point now where I think that they're really going to be able to do something that they really want with that money. But in the meantime, they've been living in fancy houses and bought a lot of protection, and they pay Otis, their bodyguard, out of that, and he does very well. So.
And you're not mentioning the detective agency.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay.
I forgot about that. I'm sorry. That yes, that's sort of the heart of the book.
It is.
How could I forget the detective agency? Yes, that Allie says. You know, Allie is the person who is. She's not ambivalent about the money because she fears it, and just as Tom does. And yet, yes, she is ambivalent. And so she says, "Well, here's something we could do with the money. At the end of the first book, we could use it to help people." And she's always said, I was thinking about small mysteries of the heart. We could solve, you know, where somebody is missing and we could find them, or that kind of thing. And she said we could call it the TNA Detective Agency. And Tom said, well, maybe we should put your initials first. But they never got around to doing that. So it is the TNA Detective Agency, and that is what they do. That's why they took on in the second book a missing person who turned out to be a dead person for a librarian friend of Allie's. And so that's what they do. And then as problems have developed, the TNA detectives have grown, and that's a quirky bunch. Those are great characters for me to play with because everybody's got something kind of interesting about them, and they add life and variety to the story.
So if you're going to write a mystery series, and mystery, after all, is largely driven by series because people get invested, you know, in the characters mm-hmm. and want to know what their forward going, the arc of their lives and all will be. Supporting players are really crucial to that, aren't they? You can't carry the whole series on the back of just like one or two leads.
No, I heard a writer at BoucherCon talking about, you know, having only three characters in the series and how difficult that got to be. So yeah, people kept walking in the door for Allie and Tom. Margot, who's a great character, who swears all the time and is just inflammatory, showed up like the very first night that they met. And the others have gathered around, so there's always somebody new. There's a new detective in the new book.
Yes, that you can have somebody new. You can also walk people out of the story. You don't necessarily you don't have to kill them off, but you know, life goes on that way.
Right.
And you can do that. So I would certainly not describe your books as cozies, but they do tend to be on a, well, what would I call it? There's a lot of humor in them. Mm-hmm. There's not overt sex and violence. Well, there's sort of hints here and there of great sex, but it's not, you know, it's not descriptive material, let's put it that way.
Okay.
How did you decide to strike that note in the books? Because you could have done them in various ways.
I refer to my series as Bad Girl Cozies because there is sex and swearing. There's a good bit of, usually that's not something that's part of it. Because Margot, you just can't shut her up. I decided that it would be, maybe it kind of decided itself, but Allie is very extemporaneous, and she says what's on her mind, and she loves Tom, and she's enthusiastic about him, and that's just kind of how it worked out.
I think you're writing within your own comfort range, and I think authors should, because if you try not to do that, you know, there's a lot of artificiality and so forth that comes in. But you're now reminding me, and I'm having a mental blank on what we called them, but in the 90s there was a whole woman sleuth movement, and you know, you had people like Kinsey Millhone, unfortunately no longer with us now, without Sue. We had V.I. Warshawski. We had a whole slug. But they were almost always private eyes, uh-huh. and they, most of them, because it was a way to show that women could function on their own. So a lot of them had martial arts or other kinds of skills.
Yeah.
They were good with guns. They had oftentimes had to have some kind of law enforcement boyfriend or connection, what might have been an uncle, whatever it all is. And then there was that whole group of, when you called them Bad Girl Cozies, I'm trying to remember what the name for those was. And it was hugely popular in the early part of this century. And there was almost always a cover where you saw a girl from the rear, and she always had like a tight skirt and incredible shoes, you know, and stockings. And I'm trying to remember what we called those. I'm just blanking out. But I think of Allie, you know, is in that school. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, even though you have trends in genre fiction where one comes up and one goes down, there's always kind of a, you know, fondness for a kind of a subgenre.
Yeah.
And I think of you as writing in that subgenre. Yeah. I wish I could remember what we called it, but it doesn't really matter.
No, but, you know, yeah, and I really I didn't think of those books as cozies to begin with. That wasn't what I thought.
No, they aren't.
And yet they have some commonality with cozies. But, they're what they are, so.
We did. We published a couple of other books early on in the same vein. Zoe Sharp wrote one with Annabelle Starkey as the lead character. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is not my morning. Obviously, I need more coffee. I'm trying to think. Was it like No Gun Intended or something similar? But it was very much in this same vein,
right,
which I really enjoyed. And then we had the Larson sisters,
okay,
who also wrote a book that was, the first one was hilarious. The hardest part of writing humorous mystery is to keep it funny without it evolving into caricature, mm-hmm. where you have to keep upping the stakes. Mm-hmm. But I think you've done a really good job with keeping humor in the book, but I don't think of them as driven by, they're not like Carl Hiaasen, or they're not like Donna Andrews, who, you know, or... Yeah. or MC Beaton, where there's, you know, kind of a gag that keeps it going, right. or you know, there's a forced nature to it after a while. Yours feels much more organic.
Yeah, I think one of the things, somebody mentioned to me, that somebody who'd read my latest book and said that they really liked it, and one of the things that they liked was that Allie was funny, but she'd never lost sight of the fact that terrible things were happening and that she was very frightened. And I think that's the balance, that Allie Harper has a really good heart. And she cares about, so it, you know, it's not that this person is dead but not missed. You know, it is that she really takes all that very seriously. And at the same time, she has sort of a, you know, a wacky perspective, and she has a wacky way of talking about it.
I think that's true. But what I think I'm grasping at is that the situations are not forced so that they can propel humor. She's being wacky, but the events that are happening are not wacky. So there's a big difference between that and somebody like Tim Dorsey or Carl Hiaasen, or people who are deliberately setting up these extreme situations. And the humor often arises from that rather than, you know, from the character's perspective on it all.
I think that's true, and I think the fact that she's the filter for what happens.
Yes, because it is her voice, not
her,
Tom's
it's
voice.
It's her voice. It's not Tom's voice. Tom has a great voice, and he certainly is the major presence in the book, so that he brings things, because of his blindness, he's sensitive to things that sighted people... sight, you know, steals everything in terms of attention. What you're looking at, really, really, it's the queen of the senses. But if you don't have it, then all those other things that he has, like really being able to hear things and sense a room and that other stuff.
He's sensitive to nuance.
Yeah, and he also, you know, he can tell when people are lying. He really has a good idea about that.
Right, and a heightened sense of smell, you know, heightened sense
that.
Of hearing. Yeah,
all of that
is definitely true. What have you learned about being blind that you might not have thought about before you started writing Tom?
A lot of that stuff, because, you know, I met Tom on the same day I met Allie. So, you know, I had my own ideas about, you know, what it would be like to be blind. I've spent time with the people at the Cleveland Sight Center. I did a book group there, and they've been great to me, and they have taught me a lot about, you know, I've walked with a white cane, and I've done all that kind of stuff. So I've had some experience, and they're good about telling me when I'm, you know, off track.
Well, I can tell that you have really enjoyed writing this series. It's been a great pleasure for me to work with you on it, and I'm looking forward to more of them. Thank you.
Thanks.